got to start playing a different game. The different game is one where we've got less match fixing. This is one that you can actually be winning. And this is the one where we actually acknowledge that, Phoebe, you've got your issues. I've got mine. The person down the road's got theirs. That in itself is enough to show that we're playing the wrong game. And the game is actually that one that we acknowledge each other's problems. They might be unique to each other, but the fact that we've got them, that's what brings us together, and that's what actually makes us human and connects us. If we can start to play that game and give each other a bit of leeway that we don't have our shit together all the time and we're not perfect, then we get to start to open up conversations. Like, it starts with, are you okay? Because that's what we've been taught.
Welcome to the Inspire to Thrive podcast. I'm your host, Phoebe Lay, and in each episode, I will be sharing with you insights from either an inspiring person or myself to help you thrive and shine online and in person. We talk about all things marketing, relationships, money, business, growth, mindset, and more. So thanks for tuning in, and I look forward to seeing you inspired to thrive.
When was the last time someone asked you how you were really feeling and you told them the truth? I'm Phoebe Lay, and today on Inspired to Thrive and Shine, I'm sitting down with Jack Davis, founder of the Australian social movement and clothing brand It's Cool to Cry, which is a mental health first aid trained advocate and a man turning grief into a revolution. After losing his girlfriend Elle to suicide in 2014, Jack tried to shut down his grief, stop therapy, and get on with it. But suppressed sadness doesn't disappear. It became anger, strained relationship, and years of struggling. And when he lost another loved one to suicide, Jack realized mental health doesn't discriminate and silence kills. And today we are going to be having a really brave, human, and necessary conversation about why not only is it okay to cry, but it's safe to as well. So let's dive in. Here's Jack Davis. Hey, Jack, welcome to the show.
Yay, that's quite a intro. Well done. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And you've been through a lot, and this is a topic that a lot of people scratch the surface of, but we're going to try and do a little bit more than scratch the surface. So I wanted to start by maybe getting you to take us back to 2014, and specifically, what was Elle like, and how do you, looking back, are there signs that we can kind of look to, or were there any signs, and is this something that people can avoid or mitigate?
First of all, great question about asking for Ellie, and I think that's important that we remember Ellie and remember the people that have died by suicide or died anyway, because they are a big part of our lives and they deserve to be spoken about. Their names deserve to be in the room with us. But you asked what Ellie was like, and Ellie, on paper or on face value, she was young and social. Ellie had mates from primary school, from her high school, her uni, all of her jobs. Ellie had a loving and supportive family, beautiful home, beautiful, safe upbringing, a mum that gave and still gives one of the world's best hugs, and a sister that she could laugh with and share things with, a dad that loved her to bits. Ellie was bright. Ellie was educated. She was about to finish a double degree, and she was a caring person. She was about to become a high school teacher. And we see those things as being the foundations of a happy and healthy life. Unfortunately for Ellie, those things started to not matter and started to not matter really quickly. And you asked about signs, and I take signs as before Ellie was sick. And when Ellie was sick, she was, you know, unable to leave the house. She didn't have the strength or motivation to get out of bed or have the shower. So we knew something was wrong then, obviously. But I think your question's really important about seeing signs, and I want to be careful what I say here, but I think it's very easy in hindsight, if we look back forensically, yes, but to catch this in real time is very, very difficult. And I'm not just using my experience with Ellie, but I'm using my experience with a mate of mine that died by suicide 18 months ago. And just like Ellie, Bo, on paper, had everything that was the foundations for happy and healthy life, a great job, a family of his own, a beautiful upbringing of his own. He had enough money to live. He had career progression. He was social. He was funny. And then you know, Bo got sick or Bo was sick and he was able to mask and hide it for a long time for us or however long it was. And then when he dies, we look back and we go and uncover what those things meant when Bo was organizing something to do with a dog or finance. And the same with Ellie. We can look back at maybe Ellie's life and try and pinpoint things where she was hurt or hurting and needing help. So I think what's important to acknowledge here is that their pain was real, but also equally as real is the shame and the stigma and the guilt and the fear of judgment that must have been carrying with them as well, that they weren't able to put their hand up earlier and they weren't able to ask for help earlier. And I think that's a really important thing to remember for all of us, is that we don't have to wait until a crisis point or the shit to hit the fan. We are allowed to go and speak about things on our mind, our struggles or our issues before they become overwhelming, because we don't want to be ending up getting to a crisis moment or something that's, you know, a lot bigger than it should be.
So how would people start those conversations? What would you suggest for young people, people that are teenagers in their 20s and 30s, really growing up in this like social world? We are instantly connected to each other through social media, but we're also connected to digital and the messages that it shares and the way people are always projecting their best selves. How would people start that conversation?
Yeah, well, I love a few of the things that you mentioned there, and especially at the end about projecting their best self. And this goes into a game which I think we're all playing, and I think it's the wrong game. It's the game that pretending everything's perfect. There's an issue with that game is that you can't win because perfection is impossible. I think we're all aware that Instagram or Facebook and TikTok, they're our highlight reels. That's great. And this is what goes on for everyone else, but what goes on behind closed doors could be very, very different for some people. So I think straight off the bat, we've got to start playing a different game. And the different game is one where it's got less match fixing, let's say. This is one that you can actually be winning. And this is the one where we actually acknowledge that, Phoebe, you've got your issues, I've got mine, the person down the road's got theirs. That in itself is enough to show that we're playing the wrong game. And the game is actually that one that we acknowledge each other's problems. They might be unique to each other, but the fact that we've got them, that's what brings us together. And that's what actually makes us human and connects us. So if we can start to play that game and give each other a bit of leeway that we don't have our shit together all the time and we're not perfect, then we get to start to open up conversations like that. So the typical conversation would be in this day and age is like something like it starts with, are you okay? Because that's what we've been taught. There's another way to start the conversation. And this, the way that I like to come from this is the complete opposite of, are you okay? And it comes from a point where rather than waiting to be asked the question and us giving the answer to, are you okay? We actually have the confidence and we're empowered enough to ask the question ourselves. And the question becomes something like, I'm not okay, can you help? I'm not okay, can you support? I'm not okay, can you listen? And then we don't have to wait for someone to ask us, because it might be the wrong person, the wrong time of day, might not have slept. There might be someone over our shoulder that we don't want to hear it. So we get to then control the conversation. We get to then make the call of action way faster, and we get help the quickest way possible. And that's by asking for it. So may or may not answer your question there, but the best way to start these conversations is by starting a game I like to call vulnerability dominoes.
Yeah.
Because if I can be vulnerable and fall over, then the next person can, and then the next person can, and then the next person can.
That's really, really true. And I think starting with, are you okay? It's such a brushed off statement. I think if someone asked me if I was okay and I wasn't, and I was putting on a mask to say that I was, that wouldn't be the question that would get me to open up. Whereas somebody else showing vulnerability is a great way for another person to share their vulnerability. And I've actually never heard anyone give this kind of response or answer. So thank you, Jack, because I think that's fantastic. If we all started with maybe sharing about what is really going on in our lives and our challenges and go beyond the surface, it allows another person to do the same. So yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and you're spot on. And I'm not having a go at, are you okay? I actually think, are you okay? We've got a lot to be thankful for, are you okay? Like, they've been at the forefront for this for years and years, and their messaging has changed now to are you okay any day, like, and the resources on their website are brilliant. And it's a very important part of the equation. But the other part of the equation is us being able to tell and say and admit and go forth and be able to ask the question and get the answers ourselves rather than wait. They both belong, but there's another way that we can do it, and that's by putting our hand up first.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I want to also touch on emotions because that's a huge part of this conversation today. I guess I firstly wanted to ask, how long did you live with that suppressed grief before it started to show up? And what did it show up as? What were some of the signs for you that were perhaps missed at the time?
This is a great question and been something that I've unpicked for years. And it wasn't until that suppressed emotion, because I prematurely halted the grieving process a few months after Ellie's death. And I just told myself not to be sad, because if I was sad, then I couldn't be happy. And if I wasn't happy, then people didn't want to hang out with me, or I wasn't showing up as the best person. But that in turn backfired, because by suppressing and bottling the sadness, it came out in unhelpful ways. And for me, that was anger. So I saw patterns in myself, it might've been 5 or 6 years after Ellie's death, where I was noticing how like angry and bitter and hot-headed I was around people that I loved, like family, friends, colleagues at work. And it was that when I was like, I just don't think this is the person that I want to be. It had changed. It had actually recommitted myself to my default operating system, which I thought was just happy, 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 angry, happy, 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 angry, which I paired that experience with Ellie with my home life or growing up, which was from a very loving home, but like high energy, high octane, high emotions, high anger. And I just thought that's who I was. So it took me a little while to realize what was going on and not being happy with it. So I took myself back to therapy and teased out, what is this? What is this? What am I doing? And came to the conclusion that I was withholding emotions and it was coming out in unhelpful ways. So even then, that's when I think there was like a second batch of grief happening. And I would find myself watching TV shows and movies and hearing stories and be in absolute bits. And I hadn't done that for years. And this went on for ages. And I still remember now, this was only 3 years ago. So, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years after Ellie's death, and just being in bits on the couch, watching shows and being so upset. And I think part of that was the content, but also part of some unresolved grief that I was still holding on to. And now I think that has, whilst grief will stay with me forever and grief stays with us forever, it does become easier to deal with on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. That's still something that, yeah, you can't shake. I think that's just part of life. And yeah, the grieving process will go on forever, but it becomes a lot easier and reactions to it can become more comfortable or more helpful compared to, you know, what I did back in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you're spot on there about the fact that grief can bleed through into other areas if you don't fully tackle it. And a lot of the time, people think that they've dealt with grief. I remember when I lost my grandpa, I thought I'd dealt with grief. And I thought, okay, this is enough. Like 6 months or 10 months is enough. It's time to start dog sitting now. I needed to have pets around and I started dog sitting. And then I eventually got my Evie, my girl. It wasn't until years later that I hit my rock bottom and I realized I actually hadn't fully dealt with my grief. Then that was when I really started to fully process and allow grief. So I would like to know, for those that might feel that this is something, maybe they resonate with some part of this, but they're like, well, what next? What does that mean? So how do we handle grief? How do we deal with grief? I know you're not a therapist, but as a human, how did you manage it for yourself?
Cool. I'm going to draw a picture and I'll explain it to each other at the same time for the people that can't watch.
Anybody that is listening, if you want to watch this episode, it's available on Spotify and YouTube in a video form.
I'll explain what I'm drawing at the same time. So what I want to try and do is understand grief. Grief's really confusing. And I feel the only way I can describe grief is sadness multiplied by confusion. That's the easiest way for me to try and grasp it. And then another way to grasp it is with a picture. So I'm going to draw a box here. This box is a square. This is a square, right? And that square is our life. Then when grief hits, and that's just day-to-day activities. And when grief hits, let's picture this grief as a big circle. Yeah. A circle sits inside that grief box, right? Or the life box. And then because it's early after the death or the loss of the pet, a job, a relationship, whatever that grief relationship to grief might be, that circle of grief hits, because it's so big, it hits the line of life a lot. And when it hits the line of life a lot, it hurts when you remember that person or hear that song, drive past the restaurant or the street or smell that smell. That's when that pang of grief hurts. So that would be very early on. Then as time goes on, the grief itself stays. The life box, the box of life stays. However, the ball of grief gets smaller, which means it hits the box of life less and less often. It doesn't mean that it hurts less though. So the ball of grief will still hit. It just hits less often, but it hurts just as much. So that's my quick and dirty ways of trying to explain and understand what grief is, how it works. Now, no one wrote the book for Jack Davis on how to grieve, and no one wrote the book on how Phoebe Leigh grieves. So I have a couple of pointers here in that whatever feels right, lean into it. And if it feels like you need to run or paint or sit with it, whatever that is, lean into that. If that's what feels right to get you through the tough moments, go ahead and do that. Where there's an asterisk against that is that you are allowed to take intentional breaks from grieving. You could be so sad for so long, you're like, nah, bugger this. I need to go and cook. I need to go watch football. I need to do whatever it is, just to take that intentional break from grieving, which is a very different thing from, I want to play golf all day so I don't have to think about grief. They're very, very different. Or I want to run all day. I want to paint all day so I don't have to think about grief. And the next day I'm going to paint so I don't have to think about grief. I'm going to cook so I don't have to think about grief. They are distractions and they will mask what we actually need to do, which is sit with this really uncomfortable, sad and shit emotion called grief. And you and I have both just described ways that it backfired on us by not leaning into it at the time. And eventually it caught up with us. So my advice to myself, it's not to anyone else, my advice to myself, when any grief will come about, it's about sitting with it and having to go maybe one step back to go two steps forward. And that's how I would deal with it.
Absolutely. I love that. Thank you so much. That was such a great, firstly, that picture really demonstrates the fact that when grief hits the edges of life, it definitely, that pain is still maybe less intense. You mentioned the frequency is less, but I think the pain can also be less as well. I do think that the pain of grief does eventually kind of subside from my own experience of grieving. But I definitely agree that you need to take grieving in a healthy way. Like if you aren't able to stop crying and you're starting to really affect your nervous system, then yeah, taking some breaks is really important. And you mentioned cooking. I think cooking's a fantastic way of connecting to ourselves and connecting to the present moment and taking ourselves out of our heads. I definitely think that art, painting, museums, travel is a fantastic way of grieving as well, because it gives us time away from our usual norm. And I think sometimes it gives us a really good opportunity to just step away and be alone and just process and be in nature. So yeah, lots and lots of fantastic examples there. Now, you have since started a business called It's Cool to Cry. It's actually not a business, it's a social enterprise, which is a very cool social enterprise. I wanted to talk about where that name came from and what it actually means to you and what you guys are doing.
Yes, this is a good question. The name, it wasn't my first pick. It was second or third. I think I originally picked like the Crying Club and I got really excited about it. I almost had t-shirts printed and then I searched on Instagram that someone had already taken it. But I'm very happy that someone had already taken it, because this now, as cool as the Crying Club was about being a collective and being together in a community, I think It's Cool to Cry is by design. This is everything has been done on purpose with this name. And the name isn't about being like, oh, crying is cool. That's not what it is. There's an element to that. But the main part of this name is that it's cool to cry, as in what I'm doing here is encouraging people to have conversations about their mental health. And if you end up crying, that's cool.
Yeah.
that it's absolute permission to cry. And it's not forcing you to do it. But if you do, who gives a shit? It's okay. It's cool. Go ahead and do it. And there's a lot of scope between crying and just starting a mental health conversation and just getting something off your chest and venting to a mate or whatever that might be. So there's a whole range of conversations we can have before we end up crying. And if you cry easily, like me sometimes, it doesn't matter. Like, it's okay. This is permission to be able to do it and own it. So that's where the idea of name came through. I'm also a sucker for alliteration. So there's a bit of cool to cry there. Love the C's sort of working in harmony there a little bit as well. But similar to my explanation then of why it came about is like we get told man up, toughen up, chin up. And whether you're male or female or any other gender, like there are other ways that we've been told not to speak about things. I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to be weak. No one will understand me. My problems aren't important enough. Positive vibes only. All these things that some we've inherited for generations and they served our parents. They might have served our grandparents, but they don't serve us anymore. So what it means to me is that we don't have to keep peddling the same shit we've heard over and over again because it didn't serve our folks and it doesn't serve us now. So why are we doing the same stuff over again when we know it doesn't work? And it's the same reason why I come at a different angle from, are you okay? We've got to start thinking a bit differently about what we've been doing. And another, we've just got to keep coming up with ways and coming up with reasons why it hasn't worked and coming up with our own reasons why it can work. And that's why giving permission to people to go and be empowered and confident and do these things and have these conversations, that's what it means to me, is like give people the right to do it, including myself. And we'll know it becomes a winner is that rather than when people speak up and it's called brave, it actually becomes normal. If people speak up now, it's brave, which is great and it's fine. But then if you're telling people to be brave, it means they've got to conjure up something and they've got to put their balls on the line or, sorry, their head on the chopping block and say, oh, I've got to be brave now. Where actually these conversations really should just be normal. And that's, I've gone on a tangent there, but that's what it means to me. Like that's where we've got to get to. Like, it can't be brave. It's got to be normal.
I literally had this conversation with someone who I really care about a month and a bit ago, just before you and I started talking, which is phenomenal. And I didn't really know what to say to this. My first entry level to like dealing with my stuff was when I was 17 years old. I was a complete wreck before that, I think. But I was all together in high school, being cool, doing all the cool things that you do as a high school teenager. And I remember bottling up a lot of grief and disappointment from my childhood, from things that had occurred in my family and things like that. And I first started to realize how freeing it was to cry in church. And you wouldn't really think that church is a place where people cry, but it is, especially when you go to one that's, I think I go to one of the most modern churches in Australia, and everyone there at the time were like teenagers, and it was really heartfelt, and it was something that really connected me to my emotions. And I remember sharing that with someone who I deeply care about, who's male, and he said to me, so good on you for being vulnerable, but I have a slight rebut to the crying. And I think sometimes a man needs to take a warrior or stance, though. Those were his exact words. Mm. What would you say to that? And is that true?
I'd just ask him why. Like, what makes him believe that? What makes him believe that he needs to have a warrior stance? I suppose he said sometimes. And, you know, maybe there is a right. Maybe there is times where men, women, all genders, they just need to, I don't know. You'd have to ask him, like, why? Why would he believe that? And there's probably some very easy reasons to figure out why he would believe that. It's because the same reasons I said before, we're not told that we can do this. You know, suicide was a crime not long ago. It's a crime in a lot of countries. It's frowned upon. It was a taboo topic for so long and you weren't supposed to talk about it. So you never spoke about it. So you never practiced it. This is why. You keep your things private. If it's mental health, it's, you're crazy or you're on crazy pills. Like there's all these things that we still carry on from generations where they were doing the best they can, but they didn't understand it like we do now. So to continue what they believed in is silly. So I understand where the guy's coming from, but it'd be interesting to know why he believes that. And then you can figure out, well, how can we unpick that? Where's the logic that we can poke holes in?
Yeah. And I think you're right in that there is a lot of passed down from many generations where parents do say, don't cry, you're not allowed to cry, that kind of thing. It's crazy. And it obviously does have a long-term effect on people. And as a society, we still need to work through. And the mission of It's Cool to Cry and the movement that you've created is really creating waves. And that's what I really love about a social enterprise like yours. And the fact that you are making mental health acceptable. I don't think your brand is necessarily saying like, it's cool to cry. Like if you're not crying, you're not cool. I think it's saying what it means is it's acceptable to cry and it's normal. And that's cool. I love that. I really love the slogan. I love the shirt that you've given me. And I remember wearing it to a dinner one day just to ignite a conversation. So, you know, I think that the clothing is igniting conversations and it's starting to spark those topics that normally people just kind of brush over. Thank you so much. And I want to wrap this up by hearing more about what's coming up in It's Cool to Cry, whether it's the t-shirts or the hoodies, like how people can get around this movement and also pickleball.
Yeah, of course. Have to talk about pickleball. So yeah, Phoebe, thanks for all your kind words and whatever I do. With It's Cool to Cry, it's about getting conversations happening. And you'll see a lot of taglines on socials and on my website saying making mental health cool. And again, that's not about getting a graphic designer to slap great logos on trendy clothes. This is about making mental health more approachable. And if we make it more approachable, we'll talk about it. If we talk about it, we'll get comfortable with it. We'll get cool with our mental health. So that's what making mental health cool is about. And it fits under the merch that mental health advocates can wear and start conversations in ad hoc, informal ways, just like you did recently. It can be around the corporate workshops that I run, updating people's attitudes around their own mental health and giving them the tools to have great conversation, or whether it's community events and fundraising events like the pickleball event thrown a fortnight ago, where we had 80 people playing pickleball and then halfway through we ran them through a conversations and connections workshop. So we were able to mix physical health with mental health, put 80 odd strangers in a room and gently, safely, but quickly break down barriers to why we can't meet people because of our own beliefs, or we can't talk about our own feelings because of our own antiquated and outdated and harmful beliefs.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. I love this community that you've built and that you are nurturing. And yeah, I just think that it's super, super important. And it's so brave as well, especially when you are talking about, you are having conversations that are as serious as suicide. And everything from the wheel of emotions, where you were showing me that you discuss the wheel of emotions, which is on the screen for anyone that's watching. And it is just such a powerful thing to practice, to have for us to really sit down, take some time out and take the time to unpack with ourselves, what are we actually experiencing? And I think that's something that we should be having a conversation about on a regular basis and really reflecting on daily. We're so attuned to jumping out of bed and like just being on complete autopilot that we sometimes forget to just stop and think and go, am I actually okay? Is it normal that I'm sleeping in so much? Or is it normal that I'm not having so much energy? Or is it normal that I don't want to see my friends? Or is it normal that my friend is being so quiet? Is he or she doing okay? And you're really teaching us how to, I guess, bring that into everyday life. So yeah, I just want to acknowledge and thank you for what you are doing and for this mission that you are on. I just think it is so powerful. And lastly, I just wanted to ask, what's something that people can do to, I guess, get involved? What are some events that are coming up, or how can people be a part of this community apart from the obvious, which is checking out It's Cool to Cry on social media and jumping on your website for the merch?
Thanks, Phoebe, for this opportunity. My first ask for people is nothing to do with me. It's more to do with them. And that's to stop comparing their mental health to other people's, because that's one of the biggest blockers that we've got out there. Someone else has it worse, because I guarantee someone else will always have it worse. So That cannot be a reason. That cannot be a reason we use to not talk about our mental health, because someone will always have it worse. So please stop using that and stop comparing our mental health. Whatever pain tolerance we can cope with is what we can cope with. It's relevant to us. So please do that first and foremost. I've just realized that I've got a friend's, his social enterprise hanging up here. It's a community down in the Mornington Peninsula called Yeah Man. If you're down in the Mornington Peninsula, go and have a look at what Ben is doing down there for the community. It's growing something very, very special down there. So please go down there and get that. And if you want to be part of It's Cool to Cry and what I'm trying to do, please just follow us on Instagram, sign up to the email list. Right now, I'm in a bit of a holding pattern waiting for something in early 2026 to arrive, which I can't announce just yet, but please just stick around, make some comments on Instagram posts or Facebook posts. Call me out if you think it's bullshit, and let's just start the conversation and keep the conversations going. And that's the way we're going to make mental health cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Thank you so much. So guys, yeah, check out It's Cool to Cry on social media, and make sure if you can share this episode with your friends and your family, if it was something that you think would be helpful or if it resonated with you. The more we get this message out there to the community, the more impact that it has. And you just never know, you could literally save someone's life. And it's a really easy way to share as well, without it being confrontational or like awkward and weird. It's just like, hey, this was really cool. Like, check this out. So it could be something that's just done really, really smoothly. And you just never know that impact that you could have on someone's life and the ripple effect of everyone that's connected to them as well. So yeah, Jack, so good to have you on. It's been such a pleasure to chat with you. So great to meet you as well. And thank you for all that you bring to the world and what you are doing. It's incredible.
Thanks, Phoebe. And just thanks for putting mental health out there. Made my day, and hopefully we've helped a few people along the way as well. So thank you very much, Phoebe.
So thanks for tuning in, and I look forward to seeing you inspired to thrive.